The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, your number one news and talk station.
The Money Show, brought to you by Old Mutual, a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Get great financial advice. Do great things. Later on The Money Show, we are looking at the science of livestock investing. It's crowd farming. And Tutuko Shezi joins me, the founder and chief executive of Livestock Wealth. Been going for 2 years, and it's got more than a handful of investors. There are more than 1,000 in the herd. But how does it work? Why will it work? These things eat and get sick. I'm highly skeptical of it, and that's why I want to have the most open mind possible. I see the romance of it. I get the idea of livestock as a store of wealth. I certainly would rather own a cow than a Bitcoin after today's 15% fall in the value of Bitcoin. Cattle are a store of wealth on this continent, and people have got a very proud heritage of owning cattle. Is this the way to do it? It's surviving 2 years on. I look forward to learning all about it. We'll talk about how you can tap into Africa's most profitable niche markets. Ben Leo, who's the chief executive at a data company called Frame, joining us. Andy Rice with Heroes and Zeros. We'll find out why Boss T is tying up with Rhodes Food Group. And Michael Jordan, who started his high-profile career as chief executive of FNB, is going into a partnership with a former colleague and launching a brand new bank. All of that is coming up this evening on The Money Show.
The Money Show,
number one news and talk station.
Hoping to touch base with Michael Jordan a bit, but first let me give you your Tricky Tuesday fast fact. The number, because we haven't done a number Tricky Tuesday fast fact for a long time. We haven't done. So the number is 50 billion. What is today's fast fact? Give us an SMS on 31702 31567 if you want to participate in this evening's Tricky Tuesday fast fact as a warm-up to the Brutal Biz quiz on Friday evening. The number is 50 billion. It's our Tricky Tuesday fast fact. What does that number represent?
Money Show. Bruce is on Twitter. At Bruce Business.
You can tweet, you can SMS, you can give us a call on 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. Anything you want to talk about this evening, you give us a shout. Are you an investor in Livestock Wealth? I would love to hear your stories about that. Also this evening, Wayne McCurry from Ashburton Fund Managers. Big story today is the resignation of the chief executive of MMI. His name is Nicolas Creer. His former boss, the ex-Momentum chief executive, Hilly Mayer, being drawn out of retirement on a 3-year contract to take over as his successor 9 years after he first stepped down. That's a big story as the world of MMI, so big that the share price rallied by as much as 7.5% today and helped the JSE to a record close. The market up 408 points to 60,649 on a day where the JSE, the Dow Jones Industrial Average went the 26,000 level for the very first time. Stock markets are running and are running very hard. Indeed. Welcome to The Money Show. For some reason, struggling to get hold of director and shareholder Rain, the chairman of a new bank called Bank Zero, Michael Jordan. I've WhatsApped him. We'll see whether or not he gives us a call. There were sweltering temperatures in Joburg and in Cape Town today. Odd to think that on the opposite side of the planet, a thermometer in a remote Siberian village, which is known as the coldest inhabited place on Earth, has broken because temperatures have plummeted to near record lows. It's a device that was put up in public as part of a PR stunt in the village of Oymyakon. I don't know how you pronounce it. It's Siberian. It was put there as a tourist attraction because it is one of the coldest places on Earth to live. And as a result, the public device that's installed in Oymyakon as a tourist attraction recorded minus 62 degrees before malfunctioning, and it malfunctioned, of course, this week. Wayne McCurry from Ashburton Fund Managers, he'll join us in just a bit as we hunt down Michael Jordan. Woolies clothing results yesterday were really disappointing, but we saw a trading update today from the Foschini Group, good Christmas sales, and also today we saw a trading update from ShopRite that the market seemed to like. The other big story we'll talk to Wayne McCurry about is the resignation of the chief executive of struggling MMI and the reappointment of Hilly Mayer, the former Momentum chief executive, who's come in to take that job, as we see the resignation of the chief executive of MMI today, Niklas Kruger. It sounds a bit like the start of a bad joke. What happens when two bankers walk into a computer shop? Well, they start a bank. Michael, your former chief executive of FNB and a former FNB colleague, Yatin Narsai, getting together and announcing the launch of a brand new bank. It'll be called Bank Zero. How exactly it's going to work? We're struggling. Lefifi. Let's answer the phones. I don't know why we're not getting hold of Michael Yordan this evening. Shame. He's trying to get hold of us. We're trying to get hold of him. And we're chasing each other around the landscape. They've got together and they've started this bank called Bank Zero. They're expecting to launch the bank toward the end of the year. And it comes in a year where Mark Barnes of the Post Office is applying for a fully fledged banking license, where Time, which is the Australian bank with South African partners, is preparing to launch in South Africa. And Discovery also will be launching its own bank in South Africa this year too. Is this the year of disruption? What are these banks going to look like? How is it going to disrupt the way in which banking works in South Africa today? And banking shares, of course, have come under a huge amount, a huge boom today in banking shares. Record levels for Standard Bank, Nedbank flying. It seems as if there is no opposition coming at all. Oh dear. It doesn't rain, but it banks. Ah, my goodness me. Michael Yordan is in Johannesburg today. He should rather be on the farm in Stellenbosch. We'd be able to get hold of him more easily. Tikiso Lefifi, my producer, is going grey as we speak. I tell you what, let's take a breather and let's see if we can get hold of Michael Yordan. Says Daniel on the SMS line, Woolworths really needs to turn into a food company and a clothes company. Please make sense to me, as the businesses are in different cycles, they require different multiples. Should Woolworths be split? That is the suggestion from Daniel, who is an avid market watcher, of course. And that is the view of Daniel tonight. What else are you looking at this evening on markets? Is it something that is intriguing you? As the Dow Jones Industrial Average hits 26,000 for the first time ever, and the investors are getting a little bit nervous about market multiples, about the levels of markets. And in South Africa, you look at the huge rally that we're seeing in the currency, 20% stronger than it was in November last year, as the currency has strengthened in anticipation of an ANC conference that went the way the market wanted. And suddenly the market, the currency is as strong as it is. Let's try Michael Yordan now. Once again, he is the director and shareholder at Rain. He's the chairman of Bank Zero. We tracked you down. You're in the big city and not used to it, Michael.
I am so sorry, Bruce, but I'm really glad to hear your voice directly now.
Not as glad as I am to hear yours. You've got a provisional license from the Reserve Bank, which you will know from bitter experience over many years of working in the banking sector. These things are as rare as hen's teeth. What have you had to do to convince the Reserve Bank that you've got a banking model that won't break the system?
Bruce, you are so right. It was a rigorous process. It was an in-depth process. They looked at every single employee, their backgrounds, whether they fit and prudent. We had to prove that we had risk models and compliance models, and that our technology was up to scratch and our security was up to scratch, and that there was an economic need for this bank. The entire process took about a year, involved a lot of paperwork. But I must give credit to the Reserve Bank. It was incredibly professional, and I'm so impressed by the central bank that we have. Obviously, we now have a lot of work still to do. We have to integrate with the entire South African payment system. But we do hope that at the end of this year, we'll be able to launch something truly exciting into an already competitive South African banking market.
I recall you once telling me at FNB that your biggest fear of a disruptive threat wasn't from Standard Bank or even from Capitec or Nedbank or Absa. It was from Facebook, or it was from Twitter, or it was from one of the new startups. The startups now that are 10 years old, you feared that they would be coming for the FNB business model. Is this precisely what you're doing now to the existing banks in South Africa?
Bruce, it astounds me that you remember that well. You should join me in having slightly more red wine, because I know you enjoy that as well.
That affects my memory quite badly, and I don't remember much, but I do remember that.
No, you're quite right. And now we're sitting on the other side of the fence, and while we probably have some distinct disadvantages like being small, The advantages we have now is largely based on technology. It has been quite incredible. It has surprised me since I've left the big corporate what is available in the market for free, in other words, open source or freeware that is out there. So the tech cost us to launch a bank is probably 1% of 1% of what it would cost an incumbent. On top of that, we're going to have a very, very narrow, focused product offering. It's going to be on a cell phone, a smartphone, and it's going to be an app. So if you don't have to support a head office structure and lots of branches across the country, you have a very low-cost structure. And that we want to bring to the benefit of customers. So what you can expect towards the end of this year is something that will be extremely competitive from a fee point of view, but also will have far more enriched functionality than we could ever offer with the legacy systems of a traditional bank.
So what are you going to offer? I mean, is it going to be a Capitec-style, very simple deposit and withdrawal mechanism? What is it? What's it going to look like?
So there's certainly value in simplicity. I think Capitec has proven that. Where we don't want to take on the banking market is in lending. We think every single bank out there offers every single lending product possible. And if you think about it, South Africa doesn't need to lend more. It actually also needs to save more. So the problem we're trying to solve is transactional banking. So it's going to be all the transactions that you can do on a bank, but it's all going to be done via mobile. So anyone who can use a smartphone is in our target market. And then we also hope to encourage a savings culture by having really attractive deposit rates. Our target market is not just limited to smartphones. We see individuals and particularly business customers. You know, the business segment is probably the one that is neglected by the banking system. They certainly pay far too much in fees, and the functionality that a typical startup or business owner wants, we think we can improve upon. But it's also going to be for families, communities like Stokvels. Anyone who has a smartphone and can download an app will be qualified to be a customer of Bank Zero.
Now, banks typically require huge amounts of capital. Regulators around the world are paranoid about runs on banks and banks not having enough money to pay their depositors out in case of an emergency. How are you going to raise sufficient capital to provide the certainty to the regulators that you will stay solvent?
Yes, Bruce. Banking is a capital-intense business, and all the regulations focus on capital adequacy. We've chosen a very interesting structure, which is a mutual banking structure. That already is a more conservative structure. We're limited in the amount of activities we can undertake, so that brings down the capital charge. We've also, as I said deliberately, we're not going to go into the lending market, and a lot of capital is held against lending exposures of banks, so that has brought it all down. So we have been able with a relatively modest amount of capital, and certainly by reducing all the risks using technology, etc., been able to acquire a banking license by only the capital contributions of all the individuals that are involved. There's no institution behind us, and we think that's a very, very good principle, first of all, because all the employees have skin in the game, the employees and directors. And then secondly, that allows you to think a little bit more broadly about the role of business in society. We're not going to try and maximize profits because we have to hold a whole lot of capital. We want to bring benefits to customers in South Africa, and we want to think long term. Both those things are really, really important for innovation.
But if you're a mutual bank, does that mean that your depositors have a stake in the business as well, that they are members of the mutual society? That's the way mutuals used to work.
Yes, that is exactly right. So the better customer you are, the more deposits you have with us, the more business you do with us, the more we would like to reward you by increasingly becoming a shareholder in our business. So right now it's just employees and directors, and 45% of it is black empowered, which we're very proud of. But in time that will change, and it will reflect the demographics of our customer base. And that too, we think, is a large innovation in the banking sector in South Africa.
Discovery is launching a bank this year. Mark Barnes is getting a fully fledged banking license for the post office this year. Time from Australia is coming to market.
Yes, it's the very antithesis of monopoly capital. You have more than 30 competitive banks in a sophisticated banking sector, but that's wonderful. That's what competition is all about. That's what brings benefits to customers. And we think it's time that South Africans experience the freedom and mobility and control and transparency that comes with mobile banking and get some relief on the fees and some better interest rates as well.
Do you still have First Rand shares?
I do, but I've had to liquidate the large majority of them for my stake in Bank Zero.
So you're using the money gained out of the formal banking sector to fund the creation of the disruptor?
I have no choice, Bruce. That's my background.
Michael Yordan, co-founder and chairman of Bank Zero, looking to launch toward the end of this year.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
And Wayne McCurry from Ashburton Fund Managers with us in studio this evening. JSE to record level,
yes.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average over 26,000. This is Christmas Mark II.
Yes.
Yes, yes. Why are you looking so tired? Things are good.
Look, things are good. South Africa, our South African shares can still run more. In a stronger rand environment, the rand hedges will battle a little bit, and the resource shares have had most of their upside. Overseas, it just looks too wonderful for words.
Yeah.
You know, everything's positive. Tax cut, economic growth, low inflation. However, understand you're very long in this cycle, eh? Been a long cycle.
It started in about the middle of 2009.
And long cycle.
And it hasn't looked back.
And valuations, to understate, are not cheap.
Yeah.
To understate it. If you, on some comparatives that I've seen, they are the second highest on record. The highest being 2008. That doesn't mean the market's going to fall tomorrow. Eh? I'm just saying you must apply some caution to all of the extremely positive news, because it's more than likely already priced into the market. Now, I cannot see any negative coming up in the shorter term, but watch the long bond that's already rising. Watch inflation. Those are the two ultimate keys. I think we're lucky enough this time there doesn't seem to be an excess anywhere. You know, like previously you could say there was a debt excess or a dot-com excess or a whatever excess. There doesn't seem to be an excess. There's certainly no excess in underlying commodity prices.
Other than perhaps an excess in enthusiasm.
Yes. Yeah. Now, and that you must just be cautious. Understand you're in the end game of this particular cycle, but it can last long. It can still last a while.
It most certainly could. And one looks at, for example, thing like the Rand, 20% stronger than it was in November. Mm. And it's hard to think of it in that sort of light. But today, 12 Rand 25,
yeah,
best levels in 2 years.
That's fair value.
And taking everyone by surprise, it would seem.
But I mean, if you look over very long terms, and of course, you know, anyone's fair value is essentially what they want it to be. But fair value is somewhere probably between 12 and 12.50, where we stand now. The Rand could go stronger. But over time, the rand is a structurally weak currency. Yep. So at fair levels, you know, you must now start considering buying rand hedge exposure, maybe taking some money overseas. But of course, because the rand's strong now and you have so much positive,
No one's going to do it.
They'll wait until around 16 again before they take money overseas.
But that is the pattern that we see.
Unfortunately.
Big news story today in financial services that Nicholas Kruger, the chief executive of MMI, stepping aside to be replaced on a 3-year contract by his predecessor, a guy called Hilly Meyer.
Predecessor.
Of course, there was somebody in between, wasn't there? Who was that?
Yabia Nivot.
Yabia Nivot, that was right. Mm. But Hilly
was there for 9-10 years, yes.
Coming back to run MMI, it's been under a lot of pressure. Share price today responding strongly.
Yeah, but look, all the SA Inks responded strongly, but MMI has clearly responded strongly on this. Momentum's at a tough time. The industry has been very, very tough, but certainly the market is enthusiastic about Healy's appointment, and so am I.
Yeah, okay. Woolies yesterday was disappointing.
Not good.
Foschini today
was good.
Cut with fine cloth.
Yeah, but understand it was all clothing, eh? All the other areas, which are obviously smaller.
Cell phones and that sort of stuff.
We're actually quite negative.
Yeah.
But the clothing was extremely positive.
And that's what they do.
That's what they do, yes. Yeah. That's Foschini. Why they call themselves TFG.
Because
just call it Foschini. But anyway, that's...
They get very grumpy when you
do
that.
They get terribly grumpy.
You'll get
about
an email tomorrow.
I probably will, yeah. But anyway. it was good, but understand, banks and retailers and the SA Life Assurers today were... strong. Very, very strong. Yes.
Rate cut on Thursday. Market seems to be pricing it in.
No, but it's coming, I think.
But the bond yield, 0.75% better off today, 8.45%.
Yes. Yeah, look, that's looking, the bond is looking good. Look, as we've spoken about 100 times, with the positive outcome of the ANC conference, you go into a virtuous cycle.
We do. Levels of the market at the end of the year.
Unfortunately, I'm not that positive because of the large rand hedge component in our share. So pick a number, 10% up.
10%
whatever
up.
That is with 66,000.
66,000.
65,000, yes.
Yeah, pick a number, just one.
65, I'll be a bit...
65,000.
I know I'm wrong, but I hope I get that direction right.
You're one of the more optimistic market commentators this year. It's going in the back of my diary for analysis end of the year.
If we're still here at the end of the year,
We don't really care. We'd just be grateful.
As long as we're still here.
Wayne McCurry is with Ashburton Fund Managers.
The Money Show.
Your number one news and talk station.
The Money Show brought to you by Old Mutual, a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Get great financial advice. Do great things. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. The Tricky Tuesday fact I shared with you earlier, the number was 50 billion. And yeah, it's the shortfall in South Africa's budget, there or thereabouts. But also, as many as 17 asset forfeiture unit cases could yield 50 billion rand for the fiscus. The amount's believed to be the result of the proceeds of crime. And the budget shortfall, well, it would be a useful cash injection for the fiscus, wouldn't it, if the asset forfeiture unit was able to deal with the huge complexity with a level of speed and dexterity which hasn't existed for quite some time. A lot of work still has to be done to secure those funds, so don't expect it to plug the budget shortfall this year. But the asset forfeiture unit obtained a High Court order in the 14th of December to seize and preserve assets worth 1.6 billion rand from McKinsey and Trillion as a result of that controversial deal involving Eskom. Today, the order was served on two of those companies. That happened today. The Tricky Tuesday fast fact, the amount of money which the asset forfeiture unit hopes it will get as a result of seizing assets of people who've been up to no good.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield.
Dave Evans joins us now. Dave Evans is the chief executive of Boss Brands, getting into bed with Rhodes Food Group. Why, Dave Evans?
Good afternoon, Bruce. Thanks a lot for having me on the show this afternoon. It's a fantastic partnership for us, so we're very excited about it. Rhodes have been great manufacturing partners of ours. They help us produce some of our products in South Africa. We started doing some work with them last year. And we decided to expand our relationship with them. They're going to be taking on sales and distribution of our products in South Africa to extend our reach and our footprint. So we think it gives us a great platform to double the reach of our business here at SA.
Do you keep the brand?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not an acquisition. It's a distribution partnership with this outstanding business. So over the last couple of years, we've extended our kind of geographic footprint overseas quite a bit, so in Europe and now more recently in the US, and so it allows us to partner with a great operator here in South Africa and make sure that our home market is well taken care of as well.
How big is your distribution currently?
So in South Africa we're about 5,500 outlets, and we think this partnership will allow us to double that over the next couple of years.
And so that'll allow you to double it to 11,000 outlets. 70% currently sold via retail, 30% via the restaurant trade. It assumes you've got about 100 million rand a year in turnover. Is that a bit ambitious?
No, I think we see lots of opportunity locally and in the market here, both in terms of distribution reach, but also pack innovation and product innovation that we've got in the pipeline. So we're very excited about the opportunities here.
Do you use the Boss brand overseas as well? Because Boss, very much a South African word, encapsulates Red Bush, Roy Boss. Is it working in Europe and the US?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, I think it's got great legs. It transports extremely well to different cultures, different languages. It's obviously synonymous with Roy Boss, So it's worked brilliantly for us. Interestingly enough, there's particularly in the Netherlands, there's a lot of Dutch people with a surname Bos, so it's been adopted quite quickly.
Well, you've got to go for the markets where it's going to be easiest first. I mean, that makes sense. When you look at the taste profile of rooibos, how is that rating? I mean, I'm sure you do lots of testing in different markets. The rooibos got a very specific flavor, and there's the underlying taste of rooibos across the range of Bos teas. Does that test well?
Absolutely. And rooibos got a naturally sweet taste profile, and so it carries natural fruit flavors spectacularly well. So, and delivers a great product taste with a low sugar content. So, it has worked extremely well in the different geographies we've gone into.
And when you sell it there, are you selling it on the health benefits? Are you selling it along the legend of rooibos?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we've always been recognised everywhere we've gone with sort of iconic, colourful packaging and sort of bright, fun brand. But certainly the health story behind rooibos, but also the fact that rooibos is a caffeine free tea is been exceptionally welcomed and people love about it. In a lot of markets overseas, rooibos is an extremely valued tea. I think sometimes in South Africa we undervalue it, but it's often a premium tea in most countries you go into, and it's extremely celebrated for its taste profile and for its health benefits. So
I mean, the beneficiation of a local product is what everybody wants to achieve in South Africa. And I was stunned to see in Thrupps at one point that there was an imported flavored German rooibos tea, and it blew my mind that the tea leaves would leave here, go to Germany, get flavored, get put in a tea bag in a box, and then sent back to South Africa. And the pricing was out of this world. Is there an opportunity for brand extension beyond just the for which Boss is famous?
Absolutely. Yeah. We've got a great, successful sports drink brand here in South Africa, so Boss Sports. And it's done fantastically for us here, and we see opportunities for that and overseas as well in future. So, rooibos is a great natural anti-inflammatory, and so it's great for sports as well. So we see lots of opportunities to extend it to different categories in beverages.
I first spoke to you guys probably 2010, 2011, when Alex Ferguson was revealed as a 10% shareholder. Is he still a shareholder?
Absolutely. A very, very proud and significant shareholder of the business. So it's fantastic having him on board, and he's been a great supporter of our brand over the years.
Does he shout at you like he used to shout at Ryan Giggs?
Yeah, he gave me a firm handshake and said, "Don't lose my money."
I think so far so good, though, eh?
It's been fantastic, yeah. No, they've been great supporters of us and added a fantastic perspective to the business as well.
Dave Evans, Chief Executive at Boss Brands. The big deal today, distribution and manufacturing deal with Rhodes Food Group. Rhodes Food Group listed on the JSE. Their biggest contribution to your groceries is the fact that they do the prepared meals for Woolies. Woolies is a big client of theirs, and now doing the distribution and manufacturing of Boss Teas. It's a big deal for Boss Teas, but it's going to be interesting to see how this contributes then to Rhodes Food Group.
The Money Show,
number one news and talk station.
Coming up on your next Money Show, Facebook's 2 billion monthly users are an important source of customers for many businesses. But issues with tampering of news and fake news and the social network announcing major changes, Business Unusual looking at how this was addressed the last time it became a significant issue. Way back in the 1920s, our shapeshifter keeps starting businesses. He's nowadays the chairman of Red and Yellow School, the business school that allows you to pay with bitcoins. We'll talk to him about whether or not that was a smart idea on the next Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield.
So how would you find a job if you had no friends in business? How would you find a job if you had no access to anybody in business? Carly Jack may have had a brainwave, co-founder at Bountly. Carly Jack, what is it exactly?
Bountly is an online tech startup that basically allows people to post tasks and allows users to go on and reply to those tasks and make an offer to the person with the task. So it's an easy, user-friendly way of people finding work in the grey area in South Africa.
Are you exploiting this notion of the gig economy? You might be dropping kids off of school and have your first meeting at 10 a.m. There's an hour between 9 and 10 and somebody needs a parcel delivered to where your meeting is. You might very well deliver that parcel and cover your fuel costs.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so I mean, it's tapping into this notion of the gig economy.
Exactly. It's just able to do things easily, quickly, hop on, post something, get something done. It's helping people clear things off their to-do list, and it's also helping other people find a secondary source of income or a primary source of income if you have a lot of time.
Who's your target market? Is it the job seeker or the advertiser of the job?
So primarily we were focusing on the job seeker because we're trying to alleviate the unemployment crisis in South Africa. That is our, you know, our primary goal. And then as a secondary, but not, you know, least focus, is obviously people having the opportunity to be able to get things done quickly and efficiently. So, yeah, I suppose we have two focuses, but our cause is to help the unemployment crisis.
What sorts of jobs are available right now?
Well, it's quite varied. I mean, you can literally go on and post anything. If you need help setting up a 60-seater dinner party and you need someone to do all the coverlays, if you need someone to do, it's online or in-person tasks. So you can have, you know, documents translated into another language. You can have people designing things for you as a graphic designer. You can have people delivering things for
you.
I could go on and on.
I've got you on that front. How do you test the integrity of the jobs on offer? Because if I am a desperate work seeker and I respond to one of these things and I get ripped off because I do the job and don't get paid, what sort of checks and balances have you got in place?
So at the moment, the site is not monetized, but so we're going to have our escrow payment portal on it. We don't release the funds to the service seeker or from the service seeker to the service provider until both parties are satisfied with the job done. So it's basically they navigate. We hope that they adhere to the rules of our site. And there's a peer-to-peer review thing like you would get on Uber or on Airbnb. So people obviously want to have the best reviews on both sides.
Okay, so it's like Airbnb, it's a little bit like Uber, it's a bit like those sites. How do you avoid running into trouble? Suddenly a trade union accuses you of being a labor broker because you're facilitating a transaction between job offerers and job seekers, and you're operating in this wonderful gray area of the gig economy.
So we have terms and conditions that both user parties have to sign and adhere to. It basically goes through every kind of variable that could happen, and it states that we are a third party and don't enter into any more transactions between service seeker and service provider. So it's basically a legal thing that they sign when they start using the platform.
Carly Jack, thank you, co-founder at Bountly. They are up and running, and it's a place where if you want to participate in the gig economy with a couple of hours spare in the day, or somebody with lots of hours spare and you're looking for some form of income and you have a skill or an energy or a capability that you're not exercising to the fullest extent of your ability, and you're looking for some income, it's a place that you can go and search around. Welcome to The Money Show. It's brought to you by the Old Mutual Investment Group. The Old Mutual Investment Group, of course, is the sponsor of The Money Show. And the Old Mutual Investment Group is a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Get great financial advice. Do great things. Welcome to The Money Show on this Tuesday evening. We spoke to Michael Jordan in the first hour of the show, and I giggled loudly as Michael Jordan described how his thing first ran shares to fund the startup capital of the brand new business that he's launching to take on First Rand Group. And it is extraordinary this year how we're going to see the emergence not only of this brand new bank, which will take deposits, called Bank Zero, but we'll also see Time Bank, which is a division of an Australian bank with some local partners, launched this year. Discovery will launch its bank finally this year after years of preparation. And it's going to target, I guess, the investec market mostly, and try to draw you into its portfolio of products. And then you've got Mark Barnes at the Post Bank also targeting the banking sector and looking for a fully fledged banking license. It's going to be fascinating to see how, as bank shares on the JSE today hit record levels, they did, just this huge exuberance towards a turnaround for the South African economy, which is imminent, but not going to be stellar this year. At best, what we're going to get, 1.5%, maybe 2% growth in this economy if we can get our politics in order in time before a ratings downgrade. Yeah, then maybe 1 or 2% this year. better than last year, better than the year before, certainly. And it'll be great. But is it enough to justify the huge share prices that you expect to pay for banks and retailers in South Africa right now? Will we have a rate cut on Thursday? This morning I would have said absolutely not. No, no ways. Suddenly, Andy Rice has tossed a coin. He's put the thumbs up. But that's what the coin says. All economists and fund managers and sensible people will tell you that there will be no rate cut this Thursday. I will tell you that it's possible that there'll be a rate cut. Why? Because suddenly the outlook has improved. And the things that were scaring the living daylights out of the Reserve Bank at the last Monetary Policy Committee have largely been addressed by virtue of the ANC elective conference. But we still have the ratings issue undecided, and we still have President Jacob Zuma in office. And so that may be enough to hold off the Reserve Bank. Would you like to see 25 basis point, a quarter of 1% cut in interest rates on Thursday? Of course you would. Should we? Probably not. Might we? Yeah, we could.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
On your number one news and talk station.
Heroes and Zeros time on a Tuesday night. Andy Rice, our Heroes and Zeros king, kingpin, the guy that decides who lives and dies in the world of advertising on a Tuesday
Lord
night.
Of all he surveys.
There we go. You really do. You are very critical generally of billboards because generally billboards are appallingly used as methods of communication.
You're so, Bruce, how many times have I said that? That the real challenge to a creative campaign is to make it work on a hoarding, make it work on a billboard, and make it work for an audience that may well be going past at 120 Ks.
In a 60 zone.
In a 60
this
zone.
Is Joburg.
And sad to say, I would guess no more than 50% of billboards can really stand up and say, we honour the creative template that we are obliged to adhere to. But there is one campaign I've seen very recently, which I think is really good. It's for a conservation body called Bird Life, and there are a number of hoardings. I saw one that was up as you drive up William Nicol going north, as you enter the kind of Sandton CBD, and Sandton known for all its development and the new buildings going up everywhere and all of the roadworks and the stuff sitting on top of buildings and things.
And this, everywhere you look are these enormous yellow cranes moving at a rate, moving cement and concrete and building materials into these monumental buildings that nobody will ever be able to get into because they'll be sitting in traffic all day. You get halfway to work and then you do a U-turn and get stuck in the traffic jam on the way home.
And for a conservation body, these cranes represent the enemy. They represent the filling of the natural spaces with artificial stuff. So this particular billboard from BirdLife South Africa cleverly, in seven words, addresses both the problem and the solution because it simply says, we love our skyline full of cranes.
And oh! How clever.
With a nice little silhouette, of a real blue crane or whatever, whichever one it is. But in just seven words, it does say, by implication, the problem is cranes and the solution would be if only our skyline were full of natural cranes. I think it's really witty, really clever. I think it works well. Even their little byline under the BirdLife logo says giving conservation wings. And I think that's nice as well.
It is.
So I think I have, I think I know who's behind this creatively. I tried to get hold of the person in question before this show, but couldn't do it. But maybe I'll give them a punt next week. If I'm right.
It's interesting, isn't it, that you're also, the messaging around this, and yes, it's effective, and yes, you're going into a very built-up area, an area that 50 years ago, somebody posted on Twitter an aerial photograph of Sandton, and I couldn't work out what was where. The Sandton Civic Center was pinpointed, which is where I think Michelangelo is. That's where the Civic Center was. And yet you couldn't really make out what the main roads were. There's a bendy road, which I think is now probably Rivonia Road, and that was in the 1967, this aerial photograph taken. And there's a big thing about area marked for development, which is the Sandton CBD, which was non-existent 50 years ago. It was lush, rolling countryside, felt, and a couple of small holdings. When you put an advert, a conservation billboard on a lost cause, is that effective? Because you're saying we haven't won the conservation battle.
Well, it may be a lost cause in that particular environment, but I don't think BirdLife is saying we want this particular area that this billboard is in to be rehabilitated. What they're saying is we want actually people to support the cause of conservation. And
it's all well and good for you to come into this area populated by big, tall, yellow metal cranes, but consider us, please, as we preserve other parts of the world you don't build on those. Yeah.
And also in the campaign, there's a couple of other witty ones, all built around the names of birds and looking for a double meaning there. So there's one that says petrel increase, P-E-T-R-E-L, as in the stormy petrel, a type of bird. Mm-hmm. Look forward to, and up with the bunting, and then we celebrate, which I think are perhaps trying a little bit too hard. The first one works so well that I will forgive them the other two.
Yeah, but no, well done. It's a really lovely campaign. Well done, BirdLife Africa, on that one. We need a zero, because we always need a zero.
Well, you know, one of the brand tactics that is increasingly popular is sponsorship. And it's because if you are an advertiser and you sign up a well-known and much-loved property and you sponsor it, then you kind of very quickly get the halo effect from that sponsored property rubbing off on your own brand. And it's kind of seen as a fast shortcut way to burnishing your own brand. But of course, it can be a double-edged sword. And the usual negative consequence is when the sponsored person or body misbehaves and gets into trouble. So we all know about Tiger Woods and Hansi Cronier and Kate Moss, all of whom earned lots of money from sponsorships, and all of whom at some point, to some extent, let that sponsoring brand down. But you also much more rarely get the situation the other way around, where the sponsoring brand lets down the whole thing and the sponsored body says, why am I associated with this guy, this loser, once again? And we've seen it very extensively and topically in the South African media recently over Steinhoff.
Steinhoff, of course, were the shirt sponsors of the Blitzbox, right?
That's absolutely right. Well, they were. That's the right verb to use there, Bruce, because they have announced by mutual consent that
you can't pay for it anymore because you've run out of money, because Marcus ran out of money and didn't know where he'd put it, that you won't be able to afford the shared sponsorship into the future, so please take it off.
SA Rugby confirmed on Monday that it had received notification from Steinhoff International that the company was withdrawing from all sponsorship activities. So here's, if you like, a sponsored property being perhaps left in the lurch. But I think the happy thing is that the Springbok Sevens team is such a strong brand with such a really good track record over recent months and years.
Oh, they'll survive it.
They'll attract an alternative sponsor very quickly indeed. Hmm. And of course, if you're in the business of shirt manufacture, you're thrilled because halfway through the life cycle of the Steinhoff shirts, along comes another sponsor.
And do fans still want to wear the Steinhoff shirts? They bought them, they've got the brand on them, and do they want to be associated with that shirt anymore? It strikes odd that a brand like Steinhoff would be a shirt sponsor in the first place. Surely a shirt sponsor is somebody who's wanting to put out a commercial brand. So Absa, for example, with the Springbok shirt sponsors. They had that pride of place logo, and somebody within Absa said, we spent so much money on sponsoring the shirts, we had no money left to tell people about our products, and we actually lost market share. Great brand awareness, but they weren't competing in the, this month we're giving you 7.5% interest on 100,000 rand deposits or whatever.
Most sponsors are told, but ignore the fact that they should really be spending several times the amount on that they've paid up front as a check to sponsor the team. They should be paying up to seven times that amount of money on leveraging the sponsorship and taking it into the marketplace.
You've got great brand awareness, and your brand is everywhere, but if you're not following it up with, here's an offer, here's an opportunity, this is what we do, it's worthless, sure.
And I think that many sponsorships are good examples of executive hubris, perhaps. They are examples of the chairman and or the CEO saying, I quite like rugby. Perhaps I should get myself a whole lot of free tickets into the corporate box and be a sponsor. Because you're right, Steinhoff is not an active brand. You can't go buy a kilo of Steinhoff.
No. Well, you can now. People will give it to you. Andy Rice with Heroes and Zeros. When sponsors go bad, what is the impact on the sponsored I think that would be almost correct. But I'm not going to challenge Andy Rice on that one. The risk of sponsorships. If the guy on your shirt goes bad, suddenly your brand is brought into it. Not luckily, because they're brilliant. The Springbok Sevens are, they're exquisite rugby players, and the team is exquisite. It's got a great track record. They will shake this off quicker than you can say fraud.
The Money Show. Bruce is on Twitter. At Bruce Business.
So what's up 1,000 points in 7 days was the question I posed to you just before Eyewitness News at 7 o'clock. And many of you fell into my vicious and well, can I say well laid trap? It is my trap after all. Yep, it's my well laid trap. And you fell for it. Thank you for that. It's not Bitcoin. But Linda Cott and others are absolutely right. It is the Dow Jones Industrial Average. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up 1,000 points in 7 days. It's Bitcoin-esque in its rise. One hopes it's not Bitcoin-esque in its pullback as and when that happens, because it's inevitable that it will. Bitcoin today, incidentally, with pressure from regulators around the world, and down 15% to 11,800, pretty much where it started the year, pretty much where I called it a bubble. So I'm delighted to see that I might be proven right today. If you did buy Bitcoin, Mashudu Masuta, at higher levels than this, then you're bleeding right now and you're hurting. But that's why you have to listen to Uncle Brucey sometimes.
The Money Show.
The Africa Business Report.
So how do you tap into Africa's profitable niches? What are Africa's profitable niches? Ben Leo is the chief executive of Frame. Ben, Frame is your data analysis people. You're an analytic company focusing on this continent.
Yes, Frame is a geospatial data analytics company focused exclusively on the continent. And our platform is powered by about 500 very high-quality household survey data sets, and combined with the latest satellite imagery and machine learning algorithms to yield hyper-local insights for our commercial clients across the continent.
Now, that was the data analyst answer. How is it useful to me? How would I use this data to decide whether or not to deliver my bread to a particular town or village, or my tins of beans to a certain part of the continent?
Yeah, well, so our clients use this in a variety of different ways. So helping them find the greatest concentrations of their customers at a neighborhood level and comparing those across the country or across countries to figure out which are the most exciting opportunities for them to target. Our retail customers use us to figure out what's the best place to open a new restaurant or a coffee chain or a hypermarket. Where are their customers in significant numbers where they think they're going to be the most profitable? Or understanding, again, at a neighborhood level, how people consume media and directly feeding that into sales and marketing campaigns. It's basically arming business people with neighborhood-level information across thousands of different characteristics so they can be more profitable, more efficient, and overall more effective.
I get how it might work in a wealthy, densely populated part of, let's say, Manhattan, for example, and you were wanting to target people who loved coffee, or you wanted to target people who loved bicycles, or whatever the case might be, or dog walkers, or dog lovers, whatever it might be. But on the African continent, which is so much more diverse, and which has got so, its geography is so much more spread out than a densely populated urban area, how does that work?
Well, that's exactly the reason why geospatial data and very localized data is so essential on the African continent, because populations will look and act very different across a single country, and even at the neighborhood level. So these kinds of data streams and analytics can inform and improve decision making, not just in a big city like Joburg or Lagos or Cairo, but even in secondary cities. And the most important thing is understanding where there are pockets of opportunity and feeding that into decisions so there can be improved outcomes, instead of what is happening for the most part right now, where these big business decisions are made by anecdote or going and spending vast amounts of money for new survey data collection, which is, it just, it puts back decisions. It's not comparable across geographies. It's challenging. So what Frame offers is an improved, more effective path forward, much more timely path for informing these strategic decisions.
So when you, for example, it's about understanding neighboring markets. So often brands make mistakes, they make bad decisions based either on instinct or whatever the case might be. It's about, and I suppose, strategic expansion and understanding where to go next, wherever your market might be.
100%. Yeah, so there's a couple of, I mean, I guess you could say there's sequence decisions. So if you're thinking about expanding outside of South Africa, the first thing you want to know is what other markets are the most attractive, and doing a benchmarking. So comparing Ghana to Kenya to Tanzania to the DRC, how do they stack up for your particular product, whether it's a biscuit or it's beer or apparel? How many of your target customers are located in these different markets? And then once you narrow it down to, let's say you choose that you want to focus on Ghana, that's not good enough in terms of executing a strategy and an operational approach. Then you need to figure out at that neighborhood level or community level that I was referring to before about which areas should you start with, which ones can come later, and making sure that you're focused where the greatest opportunity is. So every single step of that process, actionable, reliable data is super critical.
How does it work, for example, in a mining sector? Mining is such a huge industry on this continent. And if you are in a services support industry for the mining sector, how might Frame deliver useful data about the layouts of mines, the positions of mines, the locations of mines? What are the sensitivities around that sort of intelligence?
In the mining sector, it is based upon geography and the deposits. So there's a distinct science in terms of identifying where there are the greatest deposits and focusing on investment grade opportunities. Where Frame comes in is, say you're a mining company and you're thinking about a 50-year horizon for the life cycle of that mine. How would you make sure that you have positive relationships with the community around you, understanding health, education, economic opportunities for these populations, and then being able to figure out how best you can simultaneously improve the well-being of this area while operating your mine. So in that one, it's a little bit more indirect. The greatest use cases that we found for our clients are in financial services, in consumer goods, retail, in power, both big on-grid power as well as off-grid power. Those are the areas where this geospatial data and understanding African populations at really granular levels yields the most outsized impact on business decisions and operations.
Ben Leo, thank you. Chief Executive of Frame, Washington, D.C. Data analytics. And for decades, people have been talking about data and the power of data and how if you harness data, you will learn stuff. And finally, one gets the sense that all of this vast data, the data that you generate every time you Google, every time you drive your car that has got a GPS system in place, whatever it might be, you're generating reams of data, which up until now have sort of been vomited into the ether and has not really been used very effectively. For the first time, you've got these guys like Frame who are busy harnessing this data and are able then to give really good insights. I know in the fast food industry, for example, people will knock down a store on a particular street corner and put it on the opposite street corner because the data analytics that gets done by people like Frame, because they just look at traffic patterns, they look at the way footfalls happen, they look at the way in which, and invariably the decisions that are made, the data-driven decisions that are made, are far more effective. And that's what is interesting about the innovations that we're seeing in financial services, for example, with the sort of work that Discovery will do, the sort of work that no doubt Michael Jordan will do with his new venture that he's announced today, and that's Bank Zero. They will know more about you and your family and your spouse than you will probably know about yourself. And it is that level of information that will allow them to serve you better, to target you better, in a way that things like the Smart Shopper card believes it does or claims to do or whatever the case is. It's about getting real data and using that real information to serve real customers. It's fascinating, the world of big data. Coming up in a couple of minutes' time, it's the world of agriculture as you've not seen it before. About 2 years ago, Livestock Wealth launched, and I went, nah, surely not. They won't be around in 2 years' time. I said to my producers, if they're around in 2 years' time, we'll talk to them. Well, it's 2 years later. They're still around. They've gone investors. They've bought cows. I think they've got 600 investors. They're 1,200 cattle. And it's a bit like a Stockfell system and maybe the same sort of idea as a unit trust. It's certainly a crowd farming in a way that you don't have to own the land. You don't have to actually wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning to feed and inoculate the cows. Somebody else does that all for you. We'll talk about Livestock Wealth. And Tutuko Shezi, the founder and chief executive at Livestock Wealth, trained as an engineer, electrochemical engineer. He worked as a consultant at Accenture. And now he gets manure between his toes. And he looks happy about it. All of that coming up in the next half hour.
The Money Show.
The science of...
It's the science of crowd farming. We couldn't think of a better name for it than that, but I think that's what it's all about. And when you look at the various trends and things that are happening around the world, and when Livestock Wealth launched, I looked at it and I said, it's a lovely idea. The idea that somebody else will manage a herd of cows for you, that somebody else will feed the cattle, somebody else will be responsible for their security, somebody, when the time is right, will get your cattle to market, and they will pay you a return on your investment. And you never have to get manure between the ridges of your shoes. You never have to worry about your prize bull developing a cough on Christmas Day. Surely that's a good thing. And then I really struggle to understand the economics of it. The definition of a cash cow.
Yes.
Cash cow. And I went to Wikipedia and I said, give me definition of cash cow. Cash cow, business jargon for a business venture that generates a steady return of profits that far exceed the outlay of cash required to acquire or start it. And Tutuko Shezi is the founder and chief executive at Livestock Wealth. Is this a cash cow?
Of course it is. Well, cows have always been a source of wealth. You know, wars were fought over cattle. You know, it's the easiest way for people to grow wealth. In fact, it's passive income. You just let them graze there. It's compound interest every year they give birth. It really, cows, everything you see in the financial system, I believe really they borrowed all of it from cattle.
No, but I mean, cattle for a long time throughout history have been a store of wealth.
Of
the earliest conflict between settlers and indigenous people in South Africa were over cattle.
Exactly.
It was, I mean, when one looks at those early conflicts in the 1650s, it was about cattle. It was about the rights to cattle. It was about the rights to grazing.
Absolutely.
Throughout South African African history, there's been a huge, there's been conflict over cattle, but cattle have been a store of wealth.
Absolutely.
And I get that. If you are living in a rural area and you have a home and you have 100 hectares of land and it's really rich and really fertile and you can grow cattle on that land and you can have a herd of 200 cattle on that land, 2 per hectare, not too much.
Yeah, 2 per hectare, sometimes 2 per hectare, more.
Okay. If you can have two cattle per hectare, you can make a great living. But as somebody who invests via sort of a partial ownership system, I'm interested. Explain to me how this concept of Livestock Wealth works.
Sure. So what we've done is really not rocket science. We've taken a system where traditionally a farmer would have the skill of farming and would own all the cows and also own the land on which those cows are farmed. We've taken those three pillars of growing wealth and owning cattle, and we've said that not all three of them need to be owned by one person. In other words, you can farm on land you don't own, and you can own cows only on someone else's land, and then someone else manages it. Really, all we've done is just taken something that's known to work and just divided who does what. So in our case, currently we're saying buy a cow and be part of a farm and share in the profits of the farm. That's Livestock Wealth for the last 2.5 years, which we've done very successfully. And then the next piece that we in future will be doing is say, look at the land part and say, okay, now buy a farm for sale, buy some of it and earn a return only on the land rental. But then the other pillar, which is the skill part, is really where we then source in skills from different places to really manage a farm. And in South Africa, 80% of land is used for livestock farming. So if the farmers are doing so well on that land, farming alone, owning the whole farm himself, owning all the cows himself, and running the show as a mom and pop operation, surely it should work when we add technology and corporatize the farm to be able to scale so that we can have many farms where many different people own cows in that farm, are part of that farm. And then the next one, and then the next one.
Okay, so explain to me then, do you own the land? Does Livestock Wealth own the farms, or do you rent the farms?
We rent the farms for now. But for in, now. In the next, sure. Yeah, in the next 2 months, we'll change that.
Where are the farms?
So we have three farms in Senegal, in just 3 hours away in Kroonstad on the Free State.
Yeah, Senegal, I know it.
Gokstad.
My first car accident was in Senegal. Yes.
Oh, terrible.
Happy memories, yes.
Yeah, and then Gokstad, yeah. Just by the Eastern Cape border.
Yeah.
And then our first farm where we piloted in 2015 was in Vryheid, KZN, just on the border of Blood River.
And the reason for those locations, three very distinct locations, three very distinct farming communities, why separate areas like that?
It's also spreading farming risks.
Yeah.
So you want to not have all your cows in one area.
You don't want all your cows in one paddock.
Exactly. So that you're exposed to different rain patterns. And all cattle farming is growing grass. That's all you're doing. If you're a cattle farmer, you grew up on a farm.
Yeah, but you're growing grass. Yeah. You are going to church really often.
Yeah.
but there's the issue of security.
Yes.
Cattle are vulnerable on farms. Yeah. I mean, the horror stories of cattle being slaughtered in the veld and the carcass being left and the skin being taken away and just the bones being left behind. I mean, those are horror stories that you hear in rural South Africa all the time. But let's move on from that. Yeah. How many hectares of land then are you renting in each of these places?
So in total, in Gokstad is 1,800 hectares.
Sure.
Vryheid is about 560, and in Senegal is about 2,000. So we're not at capacity yet.
Yeah, but that's a lot of land.
It's quite a lot of land, which is good. But one of the things also we have learned is that with changing the way farming is done in terms of introducing there's a technique called the high density intensive grazing, where you can actually double your stocking rates by just making sure your cows graze differently and you manage the soil differently. So we've partnered with an outfit that does that. And in fact, it's all on our farms.
Are you using indigenous veld or are you planting pastures?
Indigenous veld. Indigenous veld. We believe that it needs to be kept as simple as possible, that cows need to go to the grass, and not much you bringing the grass to the cows. So we strongly believe in that.
Yeah, I mean, again, I mean, the pasture argument, you lay down a hybrid seed and you get a much better quality grass and you can get greater density of animals, but that requires big capital outlay.
Yes.
You don't own the land. You don't want to invest necessarily in that grass.
Yeah.
You've got about 600 investors right now. That's the last number I saw.
That's correct.
And 1,200 cattle.
Yes.
1,200 cattle spread across 4,000 hectares. You're not. It strikes me that you need a lot more investors buying a lot more cows.
We've got a great plan for that. So, in the last 2 years, we've been able to attract a varied demographic of investors. So in our customer base, it's 65% Black African people who love the pride of really owning cattle, and they visit the farm as often as they can as well. And we've got white Africans, we've got Indian, we've got colored, but a good 15-20% of our investors are people from Germany, from the USA, from Canada, UAE, Singapore. People who've seen us on CNN, BBC, The Guardian, etc. You know, who love what we're doing, and for them it makes sense. You know, it makes financial sense to say, it's an investment where you can see your money grow. Mm-hmm. You know, there's 1.2 billion cows on Earth, and all of them are mostly privately held, you know. So up until Livestock Wealth, it was near impossible to invest directly in a farm by owning cows. Now, so we've enabled that.
When I invest, do I have a cow with my brand on its rump? Do I get Bruce's cow on the rump? Or am I buying the equivalent of a cow unit trust?
We've kept it really simple because we believe in simplicity. So say, here's Bruce's cow. It's got a unique ID. It's part of this farm. It's managed together.
So if it steps in a meerkat hole and breaks its leg, that's the end of my cow.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. No. We've taken care of that, because everyone who owns a cow on the farm contributes to an insurance fund that then replaces any dying cows. So in fact, we keep physical cows that work as physical insurance cows. So if one dies, we take from the one that's alive and replace that one.
How do I know that my cow is my cow? Not all cattle are born equal. Some cattle are beefier and meatier and milkier or whatever the case is. I mean, because they're grades of animal.
Sure.
So how do I know what I've bought and what I've bought is mine and stays mine?
Yeah, sure. So there's three measures to that. One, every cow is branded or tattooed. So there's a unique number that's tattooed to each cow. So that's a number on your cow certificate. That's a number on your invoices. And it's also got a picture with that same branding. And it's also the same document that the auditors, in our case, Sizwe Ntsaluba Kobodo, once a year, they leave their suits and they wear shorts and they drive to the farms to check our customer records and say, okay, you got 400 cows on this farm and this is their numbers and this is according to your records, everything is kosher. So that's what that has stood us the test of time, because we, from day one, we've been really pedantic about making sure that we've got the governance right.
And but I think big change for you. Train as a chemical electrical engineer.
Electromechanical
engineer. Yeah. It's not even something I can begin to understand. Yeah. But you train as an engineer. You then go and you become a consultant and you work at Accenture as a strategy consultant.
Yeah.
And then you throw away a high-flying corporate career to go and farm. And to go and farm on behalf of other people. I mean, it's an amazing career journey.
Yeah, I always like to go back to basics to say, why is Africa not progressing? And one of the things that I've realized in my progressing, and every year in July it's savings month, people always say we have a low savings rate, etc. But I believe that the current savings products that are in South Africa at the moment are not conducive or easy to understand for the majority of the population.
Yeah.
So Real Livestock World was really born out of that, and to say, let's create a simple enough investment product where you own a cow. In this case, a cow is very much like a human being. You know, like, I think that's the most beautiful thing.
I think you're getting a bit too attached.
You
slaughter them at 36 months.
Yeah, but it's very much like a human being. So if you can understand how humans work, then you can understand cows. You know, it's 9 months gestation. You can visit the farm. In terms of how productive it can be, every year it can give birth. Every year the cow gives birth.
Do you guarantee a calf a year? Because I mean, some cattle are more fertile, like humans. Some cattle are more fertile than others. Some require human intervention in order to ensure that they're fertilized once a year. Because if you miss out a year, you miss out on an entire earnings cycle.
Yeah, but all the farmers in South Africa face the same.
This is getting messy. Children go to bed. Do you do it naturally? Do you put a bull in the camp?
Yeah, bulls and cows.
Do you put on a rubber glove?
No, bulls and cows.
Bulls and cows.
Bulls and cows, as natural as can be. So for the last 2 years, we've done that, you know, which is what all the farmers do. He has a breeding cow. Every year, once a year, 9 months pregnancy period, gives a calf, and 6 months to winning, then you sell the winner, and that's a profit for the farm. So that's what all the farmers do. That's what we've done. But what we've also done and added is a step further to say, let's produce beef. in this case, grass-fed beef.
We're going to get to the grass-fed beef in just a moment. My guest is Ntuthuko Shezi. He's the founder and chief executive at Livestock Wealth. It's a fascinating discussion into a wealth generation vehicle that has been going now for 2.5 years. There are 600 current investors. There are 1,200 cattle spread across three farms, Senekal in the Free State, Kokstad in the northeastern Cape, and Vryheid in KZN. About 4,000 hectares of farmland available. If you want to chat to Ntuthuko Shezi, give us a call now. 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702.
The Money Show.
The Science of.
Ntuthuko Shezi, founder and chief executive at Livestock Wealth. You talked about tech earlier on. How does tech help you grow cattle and service investors?
It's important for us to be able to scale. So If we were to try and scale the old farming model where I have to have 50 years farming experience and be of a farming family, we would never succeed. No. So one of the things we're doing, one is we call it a cow bit. So it's something, it's like a feed bit for a cow. So I think all our farms by the end of this year will be digitally mapped in terms of, we can be able to track your cow on the farm.
So I can go to Google Maps and see where my cow is.
An Uber car, like exactly. That's the tech we're building. In fact, we won 1.2 million rand in November from the SAB Foundation and the Technology Innovation Agency. So they're going to help us to put that tech together and get it deployed across all our farms.
And that, again, changes the game from a trust perspective. Absolutely. And from people. Lots of questions. Put your headphones on. Malik in Bedford View, the critical info into Ntuthuko Shezi.
Yes, good show. Thanks very much for taking my call. First of all, it's a great idea. I really like it. It's new and have potential. Need to know what is the initial investment and the return on it.
Okay.
I'm really interested to check.
Malik, your cell phone is horrible, but thank you for the call. Initial investment. So if you want to buy a cow, cow prices, we all want to buy a wiener, 8,000 rand a pop.
That's correct.
And you've got to put down the full 8,000 and you get a cow with your name on it.
Exactly. Okay. So 8,000 rand and you're a proud owner of a cow and you're a member of that farm that the cow is in.
What sort of return can I expect per year as a result of my investment in that cow? Because either that cow's got to give birth and...
Or the beef has to be sold.
Or the cow has to be slaughtered and sold.
Yeah.
In order for me to get a return.
Our projections for growing out the weaners to produce grass-fed beef says you buy a cow for 8 grand, and when that grown cow is sold as grass-fed beef, should generate about 18,000 rand, which is about in 24 months' time. So we've done actuarial analysis and we had some smart friends do that for us. And that's a 4% return on your capital.
Do I have to pay the equivalent of a levy in order to keep that cow on the farm?
Exactly, which is the 299
okay.
every month. That pays for the insurance, it pays for our fee. So we charge the farm that's a fee, which is about $80 a month, which is our fee as Livestock Wealth per cow. For us to be able to keep the app going, keep you updated about your cow.
But in terms of my cost is the upfront cost of the cow, yeah. and then I've got to pay you, it's called a 300 rand a month for the maintenance and preservation of that cow, and to ensure that it's well looked after, to ensure that it's fed, to ensure that when the day comes and it's time for us to make a one-way journey to the abattoir, that gets done and I then get a return.
Absolutely. So in fact, last year we returned a 16% return on the cow, on people that own cows that breed and produce weaners, because you spend.
But that's not 16% annuity income. That's an average return per
for the farm.
Okay.
Yeah.
For the farm. Luazi's a farmer. Oh, okay. You're in trouble. Headphones.
I love farmers. I'm a farmer.
Luazi, you've got a question.
Yes, Bruce. How are you?
Good.
Good. Thanks. Hi, Shezi. Luazi, I just want to emphasize. Probably said they haven't done justice to explain how much work goes into maintaining a cow to ensure that it gives you a calf every year. So it's quite an undertaking. It's a lot of work. You've got to control, you've got to control your mortality rate. You've got to control your conception rate. If a cow is not well fed or maintained in winter, it will not conceive at the time when you take it into the bulls. If your calf is not well maintained, the calf will be weak, the calf may die. So for him to guarantee your calf every year, there's a lot of work that he needs to put in, which he does, and really must commend him for that. that are just doing that approach. You probably didn't do Jala because that's every farmer's nightmare to
no,
just make sure that your mortality rate is kept at the right level, your conception rate is at the right level, and to make sure that by the time really you win a calf at 6 months, it's at the right weight so that you get your money back.
Lwazi, thank you. I mean, for city slickers, the idea of having a cow that doesn't produce a calf this year is like owning a flat that you're paying rates and taxes on and on that's got no tenant. I mean, it's a cost, and you've missed out on the revenue that the flat would bring. In the same way as not getting a calf this year, you have that problem.
We fixed that long ago. I probably didn't emphasize it earlier. So the income from the offspring is pooled and shared equally amongst the owners. So if yours did not give an offspring this year, which is expected, you know,
you will miss one from time to time.
Yes, we're working.
The bull will look at the cow and go, no, thank you.
Absolutely.
Or the cow will say no, thank you, to the bull.
Yeah, in our assumptions, it's that out of 100 cows, only 80 will give us calves.
Yeah,
and that's normal in the farming scheme. But in the part where we grow out winner calves, then there we've got more control because we don't have to worry about the cow being born because it's already there.
Breeds. I haven't asked you about breeds.
Yes, we're not breed agnostic. Any good breed that is disease resistant, which is a cross of a Brahman, a Boran, or any other tough animal that produces nice, strong calves, big enough.
I drove through a herd of Nguni cows the other day, and I stopped, and I just admired these animals. They are beautiful.
Absolutely.
But you don't get the beef yield from an Nguni cow that you get from a Brahman cross.
But you get the stocking rate. You can put more of them per hectare.
True.
So we will be doing Nguni cows as well in the near future. We just need to just partner with the right farmers.
And the skins. Oh, the skins.
And the skins. Oh, yeah, yeah. The skins are marvelous.
Mutuku Shezi, I really wish you luck with it. You're 2.5 years down the track. You've got 3 farms under your belt. You've got investors. You've got interest. The founder and chief executive of Livestock Wealth.